Midnight on the bay, lights are shining, and the sailboats sway.
And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up later on the program, our theater contributor Judith Bishop speaks with producing artistic director Joe Adler of Gable Stage. Classical arts contributor Charles Greenfield interviews maestro Giancarlo Guerrero, who will conduct the Cleveland Orchestra tonight and tomorrow at the Arsht Center. Our first guest today is Ms. Deborah Hall Green, and she is the writer and producer of the documentary Stiltsville, Generations on the Flats, about an unusual community of homes located on the seagrass flats of Biscayne Bay, east of Miami. With quite an involved story of local lore, the documentary airs on WLRN-TV Channel 17, Sunday, March 31st at 10:30 p.m. And we welcome to South Florida Arts Beat, Deborah Hall Green.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
Great. Great to have you join us, DJ Debbie, and we'll touch bases with that in just a minute. But I just love Stiltsville, and I love the South Florida history, as so many of us do. Channel 17 is kicking out so many wonderful programs about our area here, and what stories, what magnificent stories, and marvelous stories involved in Stiltsville, Generations on the Flats. So tell me how Stiltsville began. I understand that some say it goes back to the early 1920s, although the 1930s is usually cited as the beginning.
Yes, that's true. There is some evidence that it goes back to the late 1920s. It started with a gentleman by the name of Crawfish Eddie. Some people call him Crawfish Charlie. And he was really the first person to sort of claim stakes, you know, out in what we call Stiltsville now. Back then it was called the Shacks. And he had a barge of some sort that he would sell bait from and chowder from. And that's really how it started, and people, you know, started realizing, wow, you know, we could put up some sort of a presence out here. And that's when the homes and the barges started to, you know, be developed in the middle of Biscayne Bay.
Well, if you know any names of any more of the early characters, please tell us, because it had a kind of a rough, nefarious beginning, did it not, with the gentlemen's clubs, the Calvert Club and the Quarterdeck Club, and nasty things were going on out there in Biscayne Bay.
Yeah, that's what they say. That's what they say. And if you look at some of the early pictures, I mean, people would go out there all dressed up. There'd be women in fur coats and, you know, hats and things like that. And, you know, there were gentlemen's clubs. Dr. Paul George, who is the resident historian at History Miami, he said to me, oh, I'm too embarrassed to talk about some of the things that probably went on. But, yeah, there were some gentlemen clubs, you know, they say. And eventually, of course, the law did catch up, and there were some raids and things like that. But it really became a family place after that, and, you know, still is today. I mean, there are kids who grew up out there that feel just such an attachment to it. And, you know, it's really more of a family type thing these days.
So when did that occur? When did the private homes take over the gentlemen's clubs?
It was probably, I think, the Bikini Club in the late 1960s was probably the last of it. That was like one of the party houses.
Mm-hmm.
Boats would pull up and, you know, tie off, and they would have parties and things like that. And that was the late 1960s. I think it either sank or there was a fire, and that was really the beginning, you know, of the end in terms of it just being like a, you know, a reputation for being a party place.
Now, about how many sites were out there? I hesitate to call them all homes, but how many sites were there in its heyday?
You know, there were about 27
wow.
in the heyday. I think that's the most there were. The hurricanes would come along, take mm-hmm. them out here and there. One of the ones that's still standing today, the A-frame house, they think is still standing because of the architecture. It's actually built with like telephone poles that they drag through the bay, and it's like a triangle. The bottom part of it, the architecture of it, is actually sunk in the bay, and they think that that's the reason why it withstood Hurricane Andrew and things like that. But there were 27 at one point, and now there are only 7 remaining.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the sites. You mentioned the A-frame house. We might get back to that, but there's the Ellenberg home, and there was a place owned by the Miami Springs Powerboat Club.
Yep, it still is. It's a club that you can join. I think it's a private club, and you can pay dues and join, and it's actually maintained by the members of the club. It's a beautiful facility. It's probably, you know, they're all in various stages of, I don't want to say disrepair, but it's just the conditions are just so hard out there
mm-hmm.
between the birds and the salt water and the sea air. It's very difficult to maintain them, as you could probably imagine. They have to constantly be hammering the bolts back in. I mm-hmm. mean, between the winds and all the conditions, it's difficult.
Deborah Hall Green is our guest. She was the writer and producer of the documentary Stiltsville, Generations on the Flats, which will air on WLRN TV, Channel 17. Sunday, March 31st at 10:30 p.m. And if you don't get a chance to tune in at that time, you can always pick up a DVD copy on our website, WLRN.org. Go to the shop, and we've got a lot of great items for your consideration. Deborah, more houses, the Hicks House out in Stiltsville, the Lee Shaw House, and the Baldwin Sessions House, which to me looks like Frank Gehry designed it, but architect Gail Baldwin designed it.
That is true, and he is also the president of the Stiltsville Trust. Now, mm-hmm. the homes are all open to the public at this point, but you have to go through the Stiltsville Trust in order to be able to rent one of them. They definitely discourage people from just, you know, pulling up and hopping off. There has been issues with, you know, vandalism and things like that, and they really want everyone to go through the Stiltsville Trust to rent them properly and to help preserve these important, I mean, they're very important, you know, memorabilia and part of Miami's history that really needs to be preserved and protected.
I understand that in 1970, the lease laws were changed, to provide the owners with ownership of to only 25 years, and that expired July 1st, 1999. Is that when the preservation movement for Stiltsville began?
That is true. They were all given leases that expired on the same day, and I believe it was July 1st, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And Stiltsville became part of the National Park Services. So as the National Parks took over Stiltsville, the owners of the homes were allowed to retain what they call caretaker status. So rather than them actually owning the homes, they're all what we call caretakers. And the National Park Service does provide maintenance and things like that to the homes, and that's why they're now open to the public.
A public-private trust, as I understand it. So any of us regular Joes can, stay out there over a weekend if we get a permit? What's that process like?
Yeah, if you go to stiltsvilletrust.org, they can answer all of those questions in terms of how to get a permit. I think there's you have to take out an insurance certificate and things like that. But it's really very easy. I mean, even the Boy Scouts have camping trips out there. They have it open for artists and photographers and things like that. And it's really a nice public service, I think, you know, that they're now offering.
Mm-hmm. So, SOS, Save Our Stiltsville, was one of the early preservation movements that I guess gave us the Stiltsville Trust. Give me some of the names of the people involved in that, and I presume most of them were Stiltsville home owners.
Yeah, Gail Baldwin, very instrumental. He's the caretaker of the Baldwin Sessions House. Bill Tuttle, a great I think, great-grandson or great-great-grandson of Julia Tuttle, very involved. He's an attorney. He helped draft the legislation that saved Stiltsville. He is one of the caretakers on the Ellenberg House.
Mm-hmm.
And he has different partners. Some of the names are escaping me right now. But really, a lot of the people who help keep the Miami history, you know, alive, Dr. George, Arva Moore Parks, you know, people like that were very heavily involved in helping save Stiltsville. They tried to get it designated as a national
historical
landmark, but
it did not prevail. Deborah Hall Green is our guest today, opening up South Florida Art Speech. She was the writer and producer of the documentary Stiltsville Generations on the Flats. You can see it on WLRN-TV Channel 17, Sunday, March 31st at 10:30. And if you miss it, go to our website, WLRN.org, and pick up a DVD copy. It's a marvelous little slice of South Florida history. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us here on South Florida Art Speech.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me, and I wish we had more time. There's some stories that didn't make the show that, you know, got left on the cutting room floor that I would have loved to have shared with you.
Oh, that'll be next time, and we look forward to your next documentary, DJ Debbie.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, our classical arts contributor Charles Greenfield and his guest, Maestro Giancarlo Guerrero, speak about the Cleveland Orchestra's concerts tonight and tomorrow evening at the Arscht Center. Now, our theater contributor, Judith Bishop, catches up with the renowned producing artistic director of Gable Stage.
If you love theater, real theater that's filled with dramatic twists and turns and stellar performances, Gable Stage never disappoints. Like every successful organization, Gable Stage has a dynamic leader, a leader with artistic vision and impeccable taste. His name is Joseph Adler. Joe founded Gable Stage 14 years ago and has infused his productions with energy and excellence. This season is no exception. It's full of award-winning dramas from the acclaimed playwrights of our time. Their plays have already scored big on and off Broadway, and now South Florida audiences have the opportunity to see firsthand why the critics raved. Joe Adler was born in Brooklyn and graduated from Carnegie Mellon and NYU Film School. Early in his career, he directed scores of commercials and won the prestigious Clio Award. Joe also directed independent features. Then he moved to Miami, where he's made a lasting imprint on the theatrical landscape. He directed first at the Coconut Grove Playhouse, then New Theater, and Area Stage. Among his credits are 51 Carbonell Awards, the majority for his work as producing artistic director at Gable Stage. Joe has won 4 directing awards for Best Play and 2 Carbonells for Best Musical. He is our guest today on South Florida Arts Beat. Joe Adler, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. It's always great to have you join us. Gable Stage really does reflect your vision of theater, and it's both a passionate vision and an intelligent one. Tell me about your love affair with theater. When did it develop, and what captivated you?
I suppose you could say my love affair with theater started when I saw my first play. And I was fortunate at that time to have a family that took me to see some plays in New York. And looking back, and I've had this discussion with many of the actors I work with, oddly enough, I don't ever remember them taking me to see a Broadway musical. We went to see serious theater. I mean, I remember seeing Paul Muni and Ed Begley in Inherit the Wind when I was young, and being so captivated by the experience. And so my entire life I've been interested in the theater and in film. I mean, I started going to films when I was 4 or 5, I guess, and I wanted to be an actor because I thought You just automatically got up there and you did it. I didn't know somebody had to write it and direct it. So when I found that out, I decided to shift a little and get into the directing end. But no, my love affair with film and theater go back all the way to my earliest memories.
Well, Inherit the Wind certainly is an unforgettable play. What is it generally that makes a drama unforgettable?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that contribute to that. And first and foremost is connecting with the characters and something that resonates for you. And that's different for a lot of people. I mean, there are some plays, like the plays, let's say, of Martin McDonagh, that we've done several of his plays. And his plays stay in your mind because there's something so, what can I say, suspenseful and terrifying about plays like The Pillow Man. And there are plays that stay in your mind because of the character development that the play brings forth, like the play I'm currently rehearsing is about a relationship between a grandmother and a grandson. And that relationship is so rich, so full, so significant that I think people who see it can relate to the nature of their relationship, and that stays in your mind. Of course, great writing. I mean, what can you say when Shakespeare, just the sheer language of the play can be the thing that distinguishes it from other plays. And it's not just Shakespeare. You can say that about Mamet as well, his use of language. So there are many reasons why plays last and stay with you. And you know, I think my interest in theater runs the gamut from classics, Shakespeare's plays, to the most contemporary plays that are being written today.
You mentioned Mamet and McDonagh. Who do you think are our greatest living playwrights?
That's a really tough one to answer because there's so many young playwrights coming along who are truly incredible. I mean, we're privileged, for example, to have one of them right here in our community, although now we're sharing him with the rest of the world, as it were. But he grew up in Miami. Terrell Alvin McCraney was born, raised right here in South Florida, schooled in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, including New World High School of the Arts in the theater department. From there, he went on to DePaul University Theater Department and then to the arguably best graduate school for theater in the country, Yale. And now he's a celebrated playwright on several continents and an award winner. So, you know, when you talk about young playwrights, I put Terrell right up there with any of them. And as a matter of fact, Amy Herzog, who wrote the play that I was just describing about the grandmother and grandson, which is going to be opening soon, 4,000 Miles, was in his master's class, where he received his master's at Yale University after going to DePaul. They were students together in that class. So these are young playwrights that are up and coming. And, I mean, she just had a play open in New York, another one, two open this season. So there are so many new young playwrights that are writing exciting things, and I just hope they stay with us and don't go to television and film.
Well, I hope they stay with us, too. But, you know, the frustration for them and for us as lovers of theater is with all of these burgeoning great playwrights, why do we get so many revivals? Why do we have to see Picnic every 10 years? Not that there's anything wrong with it, but why does that happen? Is it economics?
That's a great question. And why also, when we get these revivals, do they usually have to have a name actor attached to them in order to get to Broadway? You know, there are a lot of reasons. And I think, look, theater is a high-risk venture at best. You know, it's a very, very risky business to bring any play to New York, not just to Broadway, but even off-Broadway, extremely expensive. And so people tend to play it safe. I think many regional theaters around the country tend to play it safe. And there are certain plays that you know you can do with some assurance. There's never, never a total assurance. You can fail even when you think you've picked something that is foolproof. You know, but too many producers and too many theater people tend to play it safe. And I certainly can't argue with that because I know what a high-risk venture putting a play on Broadway is. It's a high-risk venture even in a regional theater, even in a small regional theater like ours. One of the reasons we can do what we do is because we have 150 seats. If we had 1,000 seats, we probably wouldn't be able to do the kind of fare that we bring to Miami right now. So, you know, I don't know that I wouldn't want a large theater for that reason. I like the intimacy of our space. I like the fact that with that intimate space, a core of supporters, which we're fortunate to have, can sustain you and carry you through because they're there for you even when you make difficult choices that are not as easily accessible to an audience as some of the plays you're talking about.
I want to talk about those choices. When you look ahead to a new season, what criteria do you use in selecting the dramas you're going to present?
I try to pick plays that are fairly current. I mean, we just did Hamlet, so obviously that's not the only judgment that I'll make. But as a matter of fact, the difference here is this was a new adaptation of Hamlet, edited by Terrell McCraney, that ran only 88 minutes with no intermission. So it wasn't Hamlet, which is Shakespeare's longest play and runs 4 hours and 20 minutes. But it's still
Can
Hamlet.
I interject the
sure.
first words of the performance?
Yes.
To be or not to
yes.
be?
Yes. Well, Terrell elected to begin the play with that wonderful soliloquy, which doesn't happen for quite a while in the original version. And he made a lot of other interesting changes while still maintaining Shakespeare's language throughout. So we'll run the gamut from the occasional classic or an occasional play that could be deemed a classic because it was still, 20 years old. But in the main, I look for plays that are recent, fairly recent, and that resonate for me. You know, we're known for doing what is called edgy theater. I always wonder what people mean when they say edgy, and I think usually what they mean is that you will occasionally have nudity, you'll have more overt sex involved on stage, and you'll hear language that you usually don't hear in plays that are for family fare. So they call that edgy. Well, I guess we qualify as edgy, although we've done many plays. When I look at the list of plays we've done, not everything we do is in that vein. But if the play works for me and I think it's an exciting piece of theater, we certainly don't exclude it because of the language or the sexuality or the violence.
No, you don't. And your audience seems to be able to handle it.
We're fortunate that we have that audience that's there that will go along for the ride. We're really lucky.
Joe, we're going to take a break and then we'll be back with more from you and more about Gable Stage.
To South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. And now we return to the conversation with Judith Bishop and Joe Adler.
We're back on South Florida Arts Beat with Joseph Adler. He's the producing artistic director at Gable Stage. Joe, like it or not, critics, they're an inescapable part of the theatrical scene. You might call them a necessary evil in some cases, as witness the impact of Frank Rich, who was the Butcher of Broadway. What's your reaction as an artist to critics?
Well, I think they're extremely necessary, and they're now an endangered species. Because so many of the newspapers are in trouble. And when they cut, the first place they often cut is with the arts sections. So we desperately need the critics. And we're fortunate to have had Christine Dolan for so many years at the Herald. And she's done so much now beyond just reviewing plays. The articles she's written about the theaters, about the people who work in those theaters, are so significant in terms of making a difference, especially for new emerging theater companies. They're crucial. So she is a vital part of the South Florida theater scene. Now, we had others at other newspapers. Many of them are gone now. Many of them have turned to blogs. And that's okay, too, except that how do people find those blogs if you don't have the money to advertise them and get the word out? Christine has a blog as well. But the point is, I can see the difference, and it's significant. When there's an article pre-opening in the Herald by Christine, the phones start lighting up. When there's a good review from Christine, the phones continue to ring, and it makes a difference. I would say that along with word of mouth, the reviews are the second most important way of reaching your audience, and there's so few of them now. I mean, how few newspapers are being published right now in South Florida, and those that are don't all have theater critics. So, yes, of course, no one likes getting a bad review. But the point is, it's a significant and important way to get the word out, and it's absolutely essential.
Another essential thing in theater is casting. How do you go about it? Do you sometimes know in advance who you want, or do you hold auditions?
I hold auditions, but I sometimes know in advance. And part of the goal that we have at Gable Stage is that we want to utilize South Florida actors. We feel that that's one of the most important aspects of our mission, is to utilize those actors who are here in South Florida. Now, I think that many people don't realize what a significant number of a large number of really fine actors are here. And when I say really fine, I mean actors who could work in New York, who could work in L.A. They've chosen to be here for many different reasons, but the point is, it isn't because they're not good enough to work in those markets. They could. We're lucky they're here, and if we're going to keep them here, we've got to utilize them. So that is one of the most important aspects of our mission. So that's the first thing I look for. I rarely have to go out of South Florida, which I think most people don't realize. I've had so many people come up to me after enjoying a show, even giving a standing ovation to the actors, and they say, where do you find these people? They think we brought them in. And it's so wonderful to be able to say, we found them right here. We've worked with them for many years, and we hope to continue for many years.
You know, casting is a very interesting thing because a cast change can change the whole character of a play. I remember seeing John Malkovich and Joan Allen in Burn This. It was one of my favorite plays mm-hmm. ever. I went to see a revival, and I walked out mm-hmm. after the first act.
Well, I think absolutely it's crucial, and it's especially difficult to see a play if you've seen somebody who was really memorable, and that becomes almost a definitive portrayal of that role. I often wonder, for example, how daunting it must be to get the part of Stanley Kowalski when somebody's seen Brando playing it in Streetcar. You know, I mean, there are certain roles that just people nail it, and when you see it, and someone takes a different approach, it's very hard for you to relate to it. Now, I wonder what would have happened if you'd seen that other version first. That would be interesting. But who knows? Maybe it was an unsatisfactory choice that was made when you saw Burn This.
You know, it's a lot of it is subjective.
Absolutely. Totally.
And we could talk about theater and generalities forever, but let's get to the Gable Stage and your current season. You've got a really big play opening very, very soon, coming up this weekend.
Yes,
4,000 Miles.
Saturday. Saturday night, we open Amy Herzog's lovely play, 4,000 Miles. I said earlier, a play about a grandmother and her grandson, a play that won the Obie Award in 2012, a play that opened in a small theater Lincoln Center runs and then transferred because of its success to Lincoln Center's main theater. I think a beautiful play, a play that's received wonderful awards by what I think is the one of the great up-and-coming young playwrights. And you're going to be hearing a lot about her. She just had a play open in New York called Belleville, which got a great review in the New York Times. She had another play open in New York earlier this season called Great God Pan. We'll be hearing more about her for years to come.
You can spot them. And boy, did you spot a winner, I think. In May, you've got one of the best plays I've seen in a very long time. It's a love triangle, two gay men, one straight woman. The title is X-rated. I'm going to let you take that.
Well, we'll call it Cockfight, the play, because that was good enough for the New York Times. And obviously, cockfight is a longer version of the actual word. Which they considered unprintable at that time, which is interesting. Here we have the bastion of liberal thought, but they were the only publication that couldn't print the title. As a matter of fact, I have the distinction of having done two plays that the New York Times wouldn't print in full. The other one was The Mother Effer with a Hat. They called it The Dash with a Hat. Whereas the other newspapers were willing to print it, including the Herald, by the way, with a couple of well-placed asterisks in the two words. In any case, it's a title that is certainly catchy. And, it pertains to more than just a body part. And it's a terrific play. And by the way, I mean, oddly enough, this play has no nudity and no overt sex acts performed. So it's a play, though, that is so cutting edge because it deals with two gay men in a relationship that's very important to them. And one of them starts to become involved with a woman and what that does to the nature of their relationship and what it says about sexuality in general. So it's a very compelling piece. And I'm really pleased that we're one of the first theaters outside of the off-Broadway production last season to be able to bring it to our audience.
It's an edgy play. It's got a great script. There's banter. There's laughter. But after you stop laughing, you realize that they just said something very profound.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, that's what I think, again, makes a play important, makes a play of lasting significance. Absolutely.
This summer, July, it seems like ages and ages away, but theater lovers should mark their calendars. You've got Good People by David Lindsay.
David Lindsay, a bear. Wonderful, wonderful play, which many people think should have won the Tony Award. It was up. It was nominated. I think it's a terrific play, and it's so timely in so many ways because it speaks to the economic situation that we're in this country, and it takes place in South Boston. And I really think it's one of the better plays of the last 5-10 years. Then the final play of the season is I hate to keep saying this because it sounds like, you know, I'm just saying it because, well, I'm saying it because I truly believe it. We're lucky to have a great season this year. Sons of the Prophet by Stephen Karam is another terrific play. And these are plays that are all award winners and deservedly so. This play also deals with a family. And prophet in this case is Khalil Gibran. The family is Lebanese. And although Gibran is not a part of the play, he's referred to in the play. And I think these the remaining four plays of the season, we're about, let's see, two plays in. So we're starting the final two-thirds of the season. And I honestly can tell you, I am so, so excited about every single one of them.
Well, you know, Sons of the Prophet, I tried to see it several times in New York. Every time it was sold out. So that sounds like a really good omen for Gable Stage.
It sure is. And I'm glad you'll have a chance to see it with us.
I look forward to it. I try and see everything that you do.
You're terrific. And I'm grateful to you. And by the way, this program has done wonderful things for not just us, but for all the arts in South Florida. So when I say the critics are crucial, it is WLRN and programs like this that make a difference. Anytime I'm on this show, I see people who say, I heard you on the air on WLRN. So I can't, you know, possibly overestimate the importance of this station.
Well, we thank you for those kind words, and we thank you for joining us, and we thank you for the great theater that you produce.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Judy.
Gable Stage is located in Coral Gables on the grounds of the historic Biltmore Hotel. For more information, you can telephone 305-445-1119 or log on to their website, gablestage.org. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist and executive producer who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Now our classical arts contributor, Charles Greenfield, speaks with the renowned guest conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra about this weekend's presentations of Beethoven's Ode to the Brotherhood of All Mankind, featuring the master chorales of South Florida and Tampa Bay.
As guest conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra Miami Residency and the music director of the Nashville Symphony Orchestra, Costa Rica-born Giancarlo Guerrero is a very busy and productive man. To conclude their Miami residency this season, he will conduct March 15th and 16th Beethoven's monumental and inspiring Ninth Symphony. Accompanying Maestro Guerrero and the Cleveland Orchestra will be the Master Chorale of South Florida under Karen Kennedy and the Master Chorale of Tampa Bay under James K. Bass. The four soloists are Nicole Cabell, soprano, Elizabeth DeShong, mezzo-soprano, Garrett Sorensen, tenor, and Raymond Aceto, bass. Giancarlo Guerrero has collaborated with and is a big advocate for contemporary composers like John Corigliano, Osvaldo Golichoff, and Robert Sierra. With the Nashville Symphony on Naxos Records, he won 3 2011 Grammy Awards, including the category of Best Orchestra Performance. He has led major North American orchestras in Baltimore, Boston, Dallas, Detroit, Milwaukee, Toronto, and Vancouver. In South America, he annually conducts the renowned Orquesta Sinfonica Simón Bolívar in Caracas, Venezuela. Recently, I spoke to Giancarlo Guerrero about his career as a conductor and the upcoming concert of Beethoven's 9th, March 15th and 16th at the Arch Center with the Cleveland Orchestra. Giancarlo Guerrero, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege.
I read that you were born in Nicaragua and raised in Costa Rica. Then you went to Baylor University in Texas for your undergraduate work. How did classical music enter your life?
As most kids do, it's a hobby. My family and I moved to Costa Rica after the civil wars that hit Nicaragua and pretty much some of the other Central American countries in the late 70s. And my parents just wanted to keep me busy, something that many parents can relate to, something to do after school. And I come from a completely non-musical family, but my father always felt that I guess I had an ear for music because maybe I could carry a tune. So they signed me up for the Youth Symphony in Costa Rica, and I never looked back. But for me, it was a hobby that turned into a passion.
Is conducting an inherent gift or a learned skill? What's the learning curve?
I think it's a little bit of both. For me, it was mostly an accident, I have to tell you, because I was in the back of the orchestra as a percussionist with my two sticks, and I was very happy back then, actually making fun of conductors most of the time and trying to keep up with my playing. But my junior year in college at Baylor University, I took the mandatory conducting class. Remember, when you go to the conservatory, you have to take composition, piano, and many classes that perhaps you feel have nothing to do with your instrument. But I took conducting because I had to, and at the end of the semester, my conducting teacher at the time said that I had talent for conducting, maybe because I was used to having sticks in my hand, having good rhythms, who knows. But this was somebody that I've always admired and followed his advice very closely. And, you know, I always say that my junior year, I was bitten by the conducting bug. And since then, I haven't looked back. I do have to say that I miss playing terribly. Being a part of an ensemble is something very special and unique, and conducting can sometimes be a little lonely, but I'm not complaining. The fact that I get to work with some of the great orchestras around the world, it's an absolute privilege.
Now, who are traditional classical composers who fascinate you by their unexpectedness and slyness, their vigor and delicacy?
Every composer, I think, has a story to tell, and in the end, I think that's why their music is around even in the 21st century. I mean, whether it's Beethoven with his love of nature or Mahler with his inner demons that can apply almost to every other great composer and great artist. When we think of temperamental artists, Mahler and Tchaikovsky and even Mozart to a certain degree, these are all great composers that I think have a story to tell, and for many of them, music was the only venue and the only way that they could speak to the outside world. And I truly believe that it's not only the beauty of what they wrote and that is captivating, but more importantly, is that inner message of either joy or tragedy or anything else that people can relate to, what makes this music that feels relevant. But for me, I got to tell you, people ask me a lot what my favorite piece of music is, and I say whatever I happen to be conducting at the time, I have a duty to make it the most beautiful thing I can imagine and hopefully get that message out so audiences at least can have a connection with them. So it's always an interesting discovery, whether it's a piece that I'm doing for the first time or whether it's one of the great war horses. There's always something new and a new aspect that can be achieved through the music making.
Now, your Grammy Awards in 2011 and 2012 indicate a true love for contemporary works. How would you describe the style of leading American composers in the last decade? Is music becoming more abstract or more accessible?
I think it's becoming a little bit more acceptable. I think I feel very lucky that I am active musically in this time and age in the United States, because I think this generation of great American composers, whether the guys that have been around for 30 years or the newest generation of the guys in their 20s and their 30s, who are just writing music, I don't think so much as just to please the audience, but they want to make connection. They want to find ways of connecting the dots. I mean, we have so much information available to us. I mean, the internet and connectivity has made the world so small that people are looking for ways of basically connecting their loves of different types of music. And I see many composers really achieving that, whether it's not only through composition, but also through utilization of internet media and pages like Facebook. Nowadays, almost recording companies are being changed as we speak, because nowadays you don't need a recording company to showcase your music. All you need is an internet connection, and there you go, and a little bit of good marketing. So for me, I have to say that it has been incredible to see how many of these composers are utilizing the technology of today and allowing us to hopefully gain more and more adepts and lovers of classical music, and hopefully giving people excuses to come to the concert hall. And by doing that, I think you not only celebrate the great stuff of the past, but you're also celebrating the great warhorses of tomorrow.
We're talking about Corigliano, Golichov, Sierra, and some newer, younger composers.
Absolutely. And maybe it is my background as a percussionist that new music comes very naturally to me. Remember that most of percussion music comes from the 20th century. And the fact that over the years I have gotten to know not only their music, but I've been fortunate enough to get to know many of these composers personally, I have come to love them in a way that I want to champion their music, and I want to make sure that we leave a permanent record for the future. And remember, I'm not doing anything different than my predecessors, conductors, over the last 200 years haven't done. Remember, Mozart had world premieres, Bach had world premieres, and it requires artists and conductors and soloists to program the music and put it in front of audiences. And over decades and over centuries, in many cases, is what decides what music stays around and become part of what we now call the standard repertoire.
Let's go to the great Beethoven Ninth for March 15th and 16th at the Arts Center. It's impossible to encapsulate this monument, this mountain. It's both choral and it's orchestral, which in itself is almost a contradiction.
Isn't it? And remember, I mean, this is a piece from the first part of the 19th century, written by a composer, again, going back to the idea of composers who had inner demons. But what an incredible way to put notes and put phrases together. Beethoven, even by 21st century standards, there hasn't been anybody like him or since him. The ability that this man had to grab a single idea and be able to develop it in every imaginable way, that even if we think we know the piece, he always manages to surprise us, is one of the reasons why I think his music is so appealing. For me as a conductor, I can tell you, conducting a work like Beethoven 9 with the mighty Cleveland Orchestra is everything that a musician, a conductor, dreams about on a daily basis. And for me to get to do this in the environment of the Arts Center in Miami is just, again, the icing on the cake. And I am very fortunate that I get to look at this music from a conductor's point of view and get to study every note and see what perfection really looks like. And it is a big project for any conductor, for any orchestra to put this piece of music together. But in the end, for audiences, it doesn't matter where it's being played or how or when it's being played. It always manages to reach the absolute highs artistically that people are always looking for when they attend performances. And remember, Beethoven 9, at least for me, is one of the main reasons why I became a professional musician. It is that music that turned me on to becoming a classical musician.
Is there an emotional peak, for example, in the fourth movement, or do we go backwards for you? Is it just start from the beginning and it's just emotional the entire voyage?
You're touching on something that is inherent to Beethoven. Beethoven is filled with climaxes, with mini-climaxes, as we like to call them. And from the very beginning, he puts you on the edge of the seat. Even the very opening with this mysterious chord that it almost feels like the orchestra is still tuning up. It almost feels like things haven't really gotten before you know it. He gives you this big splash that literally it's like throws you back into your seat. And then you get back into comfortability. And yet again, he takes you for another spin. Great music, and Beethoven is no stranger to this, are the ones who are capable of literally playing with your emotions and allowing you to not only dream, but also be able to feel tragedy, be also be able to feel danger. That's what we want to see. And as we are listening to this music in our head, we're able to create imagery. And we connect this with stuff that has happened in our own life. And that's what I always tell audiences when they attend performances. Listening to a piece of music is such a personal experience that it is truly a reflection of who we are and where we come from. And we all listen to it with different ears based on where we came. And that applies to the conductor and to the person sitting on row C and to the string bass player or the oboe player in the orchestra. We all listen to it with different ears, and we're being told a different part of the story.
And at the end with that little piccolo, which always picks me up, puts a big smile on my face.
To talk about waiting until the last moment, remember, the piccolo only comes in at the last moment, as well as the chorus, as well as the soloist, as well as the percussion as well. So talk about saving, I guess, those moments for that actual big climax at the end of the piece. And even when you think that the man cannot take you any higher, he manages to surprise you. He manages to kick it up a notch even higher. And it is so, so gloriously done, combining not only incredible music, but also incredible text. So it is, again, a piece that even in 2013, it manages to capture people's imagination.
Well, Giancarlo Guerrero, I want to thank you so much for attending today's South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you very soon.
Thank you. The Cleveland Orchestra Miami Residency, its musical director Franz Welsermost, and guest conductor Giancarlo Guerrero continue their warm and productive relationship with South Florida during its winter-spring musical season. The Cleveland Orchestra image as a world-class orchestra with solid programming and a musical outreach program are powerful incentives and emollients within our local cultural fabric. Their local programming has reached over 3,500 grade school students in free concerts, and they also work with the New World Symphony and the University of Miami through master classes, coachings, and seminars. Overall, the Cleveland Orchestra Miami Residency makes us all look good. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield is a classical music contributor for the Sun Sentinel and has written for the Miami Herald. You can email him at cdgpm@bellsouth.net. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat continues in just a moment. And Sunday, March 24th at Hollywood Arts Park, it's Peace in the Park, Festival of Spirit. Famed drummer Willie Stewart, jazz and blues vocalist and violinist Nicole Yarling, Peter Baton and Mark Berner, and many other musicians will be coming together for Peace. WLRN's Wanda Miles will host the event once again Sunday, March 24th at Hollywood Arts Park from 1 to 6 p.m. It's free, and for more information, you can call 954-962-7447 or go to peaceinthepark.florida.org. And you can celebrate Coral Springs' 50th anniversary in a community birthday celebration at the 9th Annual Coral Springs Festival of the Arts this weekend, March 16th. And 17th, taking place at the Walk on University Drive. It's a fun-packed weekend for the entire family with artists, crafts, musical entertainment, literary seminars, chalk artists, a children's area, and much, much more. For more info on that, go to csfoa.org or call 954-340-5992. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our new beautiful website at WLRN.org for more info. That's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Judith Bishop and Charles Greenfield. Call us with your comments at 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information, 305-995-2221, or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and as always, please keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.